Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California is home to 12% of the nation's population, but we also make up 30% of the unhoused population in the country. The big questions are why? Why are so many people experiencing homelessness here? And what truly can be done to start working on solutions to this crisis? For years, elected officials have run on the platform of solving this issue. And over the years, the unhoused population has ballooned into what we see today in just about any corner of California. But no one has been able to crack the code, despite their best intentions. Now, a newly released study from UC San Francisco has pinpointed the main root causes of homelessness in California, offers some concrete solutions, and demystifies some common misconceptions. It is the largest representative study of homelessness in California in 3 decades. Joining us now to talk about the study is Dr. Margot Kuschel, director of the Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative and principal investigator of the statewide study of people experiencing homelessness. Good morning, Dr. Kuschel.
Good morning.
So for context, let's just start with the UCSF Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative. What is it?
Yeah, we're a group of researchers, data scientists, qualitative researchers, and policy folks who are trying to demystify homelessness a bit. We conduct research when there are questions that are unanswered and try to translate those to the public and to policymakers. Sometimes we do our own research. Sometimes we're just helping to interpret what's already out there.
Homelessness is something that we are all touched by. It's something that we get a front row seat to. But with your research and at this housing initiative, homelessness and housing initiative, how did you get a better understanding of the state of homelessness and how it has evolved in just the past few years?
So we set out to try to understand homelessness throughout the state, really focusing on homeless adults. We divided the state into 8 regions based on a bunch of factors and basically used a computer model to help choose 8 counties that we felt like put together could give us a sense of the state as a whole. In those counties, we took a huge inventory of every place where people experiencing homelessness might be. That was things like shelters and food lines, but also encampments and parks and the like. And then we randomly selected those places. We sent teams in, you know, our teams going in with teams from those counties, and basically took a random sample of everybody experiencing homelessness there, did about a 45-minute interview to understand what was going on in their lives, and then selected, based on their answers, about 1 in 8 of them to do in-depth interviews, where we turned on the microphone and asked them a bunch of questions to try to understand really the story behind the story. So we did 3,200 surveys and 365 in-depth interviews.
What about those who have language barriers?
So we did the interviews in English and Spanish. Our team was bilingual, bicultural for English and Spanish speakers. And then for any other languages we encountered, we used trained interpreters. Mm-hmm.
So you conducted over 3,000 questionnaires and several hundred, you know, in-depth interviews. Over what span of time were you looking at?
Yeah, we started in October of 21 and we finished in November of 22. So we were in each community for between 3 and 6 weeks, depending on the size of the community during that time span.
Hmm. What took so long for a study of this kind? I mean, homelessness has been an issue that has just been escalating in recent years. And the last one of this nature was from the 1990s.
Yeah, you know, most of the way we know things about people's health or their behaviors comes from what we call household surveys, things like the census. Doing the similar things on people experiencing homelessness is just much more logistically and technically hard. And there really hadn't been one of this scale since the rise of unsheltered homelessness, where it's even harder to find people. And so we really, it's logistically complicated to do. We worked alongside an incredible advisory board made up of people themselves who either are or recently had been homeless who advised us. We hired people from the communities who themselves either are homeless or had recently been homeless to serve as guides and community workers to introduce us to people to gain trust. These studies are hard to do, but I do think it's important.
The study found that when it came to the number one cause of homelessness in our state, it's affordability. It's affordability of housing. What did you learn from the people that you interviewed and questioned?
Yeah, what was really incredible was that the median household income in the months before homelessness, so how much the whole household earned, either through earned income like work or benefits, for a month was $960. This is an incredibly expensive state. And people told us that eventually they just couldn't pay the rent. In fact, there were about 20% of everyone came straight out of an institution, prisons, jails, drug treatment programs, hospitals and the like. For the other about 80%, 60% of those came from what we called a non-leaseholder situation. They had already been evicted or threatened with eviction and had left and were living with friends or families, often not paying rent. The other 40% were coming straight from a leaseholding situation. And the main thing that really drove people out was just this inability to keep up with the rent. And then when they became homeless, things got even worse. Their income went down further, their health deteriorated, things got even worse, and they were in an even bigger hole.
Did you get a better idea of who was experiencing homelessness the most in the state?
Yeah, I mean, Black folks and Indigenous folks are dramatically overrepresented amongst people experiencing homelessness. In our study, 20% of people identified their sole racial or ethnic identity as Black, an additional 6% as one of their identities. This compares to about 5 to 8% of the state. With Indigenous, similarly, 3% said that their identity was that they were Native American or Alaska Native. An additional 9% said that that was one of their identities. These are huge overrepresentations. And we saw what other people have started to see in point in time counts, which is increasing numbers of people who identify as Latinx experiencing homelessness.
This study also dispels some common misconceptions that generally people can have when they think about someone experiencing homelessness. One of them was that, this idea that California is being flooded by people from other states because of our liberal or more forgiving policies. But your study found something different about that, that wasn't true.
Yeah, I mean, 90% of people lost their last stable housing in California. So they were last stably housed in California. Interestingly, of the 10% who did not lose their last housing in California, 30% of those were born in California and were basically coming home. We heard lots of stories of those folks sort of coming back to stay with mom or someone, and then it didn't work out. Really, these are our neighbors, our friends, these are our fellow Californians experienced this crisis.
Do you know how long, did you get a span of time of how long someone experiences homelessness?
Yeah, in our study, the median length of time was 22
It's almost
months.
2 years.
So, yeah, almost 2 years. So once people fall into homelessness in California, because the housing is so expensive, because it's so hard, because it's so disorienting to be homeless, they stay homeless for a long time.
There's also this idea or this argument of like pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, right? And so the study also in this questionnaire and interviews, you looked at the picture of, someone experiencing homelessness, trying to find work or a way to support themselves. What did you find out?
Yeah, it was really heartbreaking. A few things. One is that people were really disconnected from labor markets. Something like three quarters hadn't worked 20 hours a week or more in 2 years. 2 years was actually the length of time people had been homeless. But when we asked people about work, 45% were actively looking for work. People told us that they wanted to work, that they wanted to get back out there, but they told us of so many barriers that they experienced, how hard it was to find a job. They had no transportation, they had no shower, they had no place to sleep. It was just too overwhelming.
Yeah, I talked to people who were experiencing homelessness, living in an encampment, and they had a full-time job. They just couldn't afford the rent, or they couldn't afford housing. There are other big pieces of this when it comes to barriers. You have mental health, behavioral issues, substance abuse, and trauma. I mean, these are also nuanced. How did you get a better understanding from actually talking to people, directly impacted by something that is very personal and very circumstantial?
Yeah, I mean, what was really striking was how much trauma people had experienced before they became homeless, trauma in their childhoods, trauma in their adulthood, physical and sexual violence. Sometimes people had been incarcerated and experienced that is incredibly traumatic. People experienced tremendous amount of trauma when they were homeless. 10% of everybody had been sexually assaulted during this episode of homelessness. And certainly people had behavioral health concerns. About a quarter had ever in their life been in a psychiatric hospital. About almost that many, a little less than that, reported that they experienced hallucinations in their life. Right now, about 12% experience hallucinations, much, much higher percentage experience serious depression, serious anxiety. Those were the main mental health problems. And substance use was certainly common. About almost a third of people were using methamphetamines regularly.
I mean, given that this is something that you research, were you surprised by anything in this study? Because what we're talking about, we've had lots of conversations about these in parts on Insight, but now you're getting really kind of this comprehensive view. Did anything surprise you?
I mean, a few things that surprised me, people had almost no warning before they lost their housing. We speak a lot about homelessness prevention, but people had a median of 5 days warning. Those without leases had 1 day warning, and those with leases only 10 days warning before they lost their housing. I think in a way, this tells us how difficult this task is that we're trying to do. I think that how disconnected people were from services, from help, how many people wanted substance use treatment but were unable to get it, that was really shattering. And just the amount, the constancy of the violence, physical assault, sexual assault that people were experiencing, and how that was derailing their efforts to get back into housing was devastating as well. But in a way, perhaps it wasn't surprising when we asked people what was keeping them from being housed, the number one response, the rent is too high.
Yeah. I mean, if they're making $960 a month, I mean, that's not sustainable or even realistic in this state, in any corner of the state. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Margot Kuschel, director of the Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative at UCSF, about their latest report and study on homelessness in California, which is the first of its kind since the 1990s. So when it comes to solutions and sustainable solutions, the crisis of homelessness has really been a political football for decades. I mean, why has no one really been able to find some meaningful solutions that we, the public, can see, you know, from our front door and in our communities?
I mean, one of the problems is that people often blame the homeless service systems for not doing a good enough job. But really, the homeless service systems is frantically trying to keep up with the crisis and is really just there to manage the emergency. What we need is going to be hard to do, but I actually believe Californians can do hard things and we can do this. We need to bring down the cost of housing. We need to greatly expand the availability of housing for low-income people, and we need to increase incomes. That, at the end of the day, is what we need to do, and we need to keep our focus on that.
Do you see this as a political issue where lawmakers are largely the ones who hold the keys to figuring this out?
I mean, I think that lawmakers can't get that far ahead of the general public. And I think the general public sees people suffering in encampments, is bothered by them, and comes up with a narrative about what's causing this and therefore what would be the solution. There's actually been really good evidence going back for many years that to get people housed, we need to start with the housing. You know, people face so many barriers and we just need to get them into housing and help them rebuild their lives from there. In California, we have only 24 units of housing that's affordable and available for every 100 extremely low-income households. We have 1.3 million extremely low-income households. We're 1 million units short. I hate in some ways to be the bearer of bad news, but unless we can fix that, unless we can make progress, we're not going to be able to solve this problem. The good news, just a few years ago, we were at 21. Now we're at 24. We are actually seeing some forward movement where many states around us are going in the wrong direction. I hope that we can continue that movement, continue to not get distracted by the shiniest, you know, most sensational story, continue to not be distracted by myths that these are people coming from elsewhere or others, and actually just focus on the real solutions.
In addition to creating housing, local government cities, in particularly, they've been taking measures into their own hands. Sacramento, specifically, for example, they recently passed voters passed Measure O, and that essentially bans people from camping in public spaces, and that can lead to fines if warnings to move out of the public area are not adhered to, and available shelter is not accepted. With your experience, are these realistic solutions? Do they actually work, or are they just a window dressing to appease people who are frustrated?
Look, I can understand why there's an instinct to create laws like that. People are expressing their frustration, but it isn't actually helping anything. It's just moving really desperate people from one part of town to the other. And what we learned are that these tickets, you know, are another barrier to getting housing. People having their goods thrown away is another barrier. 50% of people told us not having documents kept them from being able to rent apartments or get jobs. When we asked where their documents went, sometimes it was that they got thrown out in encampment sweeps and things. I understand why people have that instinct to do it, but I don't think it's serving us well.
Dr. Kushal, thank you so much for the time and the work doing this study.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Margot Kushal is the director of the Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative and principal investigator of the California Study for People Experiencing Homelessness. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This weekend, a new show took to public radio airwaves inside Solano State Prison, where those incarcerated are DJs. The radio show is more than a music playlist, but an opportunity for those inside prison to storytell and share how certain songs shaped their lives. The Uncuffed playlist is part of KALW, a public media station based in San Francisco, which says this is California's first radio music program hosted by incarcerated people and broadcast to the general public. This is also part of a larger audio storytelling program that has been going on inside San Quentin State Prison for more than a decade, expanding to Solano State Prison in 2018. In that time, the Uncuffed podcast has over 200,000 downloads, and once released, graduates have gone on to careers in media and advocacy. Here's a little taste.
We rolling.
Man, let's get this thing cracking.
Let's get it.
Bring it.
Let's do it.
What?
Coming at you from Solano State Prison in the rolling hills of the Golden State.
And from the Bay of San Francisco at San Quentin State Prison.
This is Uncuffed.
Uncuffed is about telling our stories from our perspectives.
From the perspective of a person who hasn't had his story told.
We bring them down to the studio, or we record them, and then we edit it ourselves.
Uncuffed is like a golden conduit. It allows us to release emotions that's been pent up for years, to understand and unwind.
A program that has afforded incarcerated men the opportunity to tell their stories and the stories of other incarcerated men.
And we came together to learn radio, produce radio.
It's about sharing with other people and making connections with other people.
Joining us now is Eli Wirtschafter, the Uncuffed Program Director, Mariah Yates, the lead teacher of the Uncuffed Broadcast DJ Program inside Solano State Prison, and Chanton Bunn, a graduate of the Storytelling Program at San Quentin State Prison and a former co-host of the Uncuffed podcast. Good morning to you all.
Good morning, Vicky.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning.
All right. Good morning. Good morning. All right, Eli, I want to start with you. Who came up with this idea more than a decade ago?
You know, I wasn't around in the program at that time, but as I understand, you know, San Quentin News has been going on a long time, the wonderful newspaper out of San Quentin produced by incarcerated people. And so there were some reporters and editors at our station, KALW, who started to visit that newspaper program. And it was some incarcerated folks who were there at San Quentin who said, let's have a radio show here. Bring us the equipment, teach us. We want to learn how to do this. So our station started helping facilitate incarcerated people there at San Quentin, making radio stories, airing them on our station. And that's how it all began.
Hmm. Why do you think it's endured for more than a decade and counting at San Quentin and now in its fifth year at Solano State Prison?
Well, it's easy for us why we want to keep doing it. The stories are incredible and so important for our listeners to hear this important part of our community that so often doesn't get heard and so often doesn't get to share their own experiences as journalists. To get to be the storytellers and not just the subject of stories is really important to us and something that this program makes possible. For the participants, they're learning skills. They love it. They love the chance to be heard. And then, you know, why is it still going is the prison system actually allows it and endorses it. They understand that this is an amazing rehabilitative opportunity for incarcerated people.
How many people have been part of Uncuffed in all these years, do you think?
I know we've had over 60 people interviewed on the program. It's probably a good bit higher than that. Number of graduates is a little bit fuzzier, but in the dozens.
Yeah. What are the qualifications? How can you become part of the program?
You know, we open it up to anyone at either of the prisons we work at, Solano and San Quentin, who wants to join. You have to get on a wait list. And from there, we don't have any restrictions such as, you know, what crime were you convicted for or how long have you spent in prison or are you going to get out? We've worked with people who are LWOPs, life without the opportunity of parole. So, you know, we don't try to, it's not strictly about, are you going to be able to use these skills after prison? You know, we want to validate that anyone who wants to tell their story, wants to help others tell their stories, can have this opportunity.
All right, Chanton, that brings me to you. How did you become connected with the Uncuffed program?
Yeah, I was on a yard with Lewis A. Scott, and we used to talk a lot. And he told me that, hey, you have a lot to share. I never thought I would ever go on radio or even like speak about some of my experiences. But he dragged me down there, and a KOW and Uncuffed program taught me how to write my story, write stories that I'm interested in, tell stories of folks and their experience. And I enjoyed it. And from then on, I've been with Uncuffed off and on out here.
Mm. Yeah, I was watching a video that was showing how Uncuffed worked, and we played a bit of it at the beginning of this conversation. And I remember you shared something, Chanton, saying that just kind of like the value of not just sharing and opening up among friends, like people that are familiar to you, but also opening up to an audience, to listeners, and the value of that. How did being part of the Uncuffed program deepen your understanding of yourself and also others?
It's about sharing. A lot of us, and especially like myself, being incarcerated was shameful. Just sharing our story and humanizing my own story and not villainizing myself all my life really helped. And then seeing folks that hear my story and as we share, also seeing that, and that really helped me in my own journey of self-redemption.
I mean, getting reflective, you know, isn't always comfortable, but it obviously pays dividends because it gives you an understanding, all of us a better understanding when we do it, of kind of like our own root causes. And in your case, of experiencing incarceration.
Yeah, experiencing incarceration. And also I'm a genocide survivor. Mm. So,
and trauma.
There was so much trauma within me that I had all my life. Keeping it to myself was not helping, and being able to share and learning how to share really helped me understand myself and what I went through, and also helped me understand my trauma.
How was it being able to have some of those listeners be loved ones listening to you and your work and your voice?
At first they were surprised that I even done radio, and like, oh, you're on the radio. But especially to folks, my family and my mother, it also helped because these are things that we don't talk about. There's things I talk about on air that me and my family never talked about, but hearing my stories it opened up a conversation when I came home. It opened up a lot of understanding, and it opened up a communication that we've never had.
I would imagine that self-awareness, you know, it also can build confidence. It can build self-worth. There is a rehabilitation program at Rio Casumnes Correctional Center here in Sacramento County, and it's called Redemption Coffee, and you train people in the coffee industry. And I spoke with someone who was part of that program, and they were connected to the coffee industry once they were released. And one of the things that really stuck with me was kind of this humanizing element from these rehabilitation programs, which is obvious when you think about it. And for her, it was realizing that, you know, for her, it was that she committed a felony, but she is not a felon, you know, and that really changed the way she viewed herself and her place in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. In a lot of our storytelling, we often remind folks that we are impacted, we are felons, but we're not that one act that happened decades ago. And coming home with the skills that I've gained from KLW and doing Uncuff allowed me to have pride in myself and to have a knowledge of how to tell narrative. And since coming home, I was an advocate for immigration rights, which I am in danger for. And the skills that were taught to me doing radio and podcasting helped me use all those skills to advocate for my community, advocate for myself. And it's been a tool that I use daily. When I'm working with my reentry, and without the skills that I've learned, I don't think that I could tell my narrative and speak the way I do. So it carries a lot, and it gives me a lot of pride that I could do that for my community.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're learning more about the Uncuffed Audio Storytelling Program inside San Quentin and Solano State Prisons. Okay, Mariah, so let's get into this new piece of the program. This is the Uncuffed Playlist at Solano State Prison. Why expand to a DJ podcast or playlist?
Radio has always had the two sides to it, talk radio and music. And it felt like the right time to expand the program from a podcast focused program to also include music. And music can be such a vehicle for expression. It's a real stepping stone. And sometimes music can say something that a person isn't quite ready to say out loud for themselves.
What are some of the topics that student DJs are wanting to talk about?
There's a wide range of topics, but some would include brotherhood, redemption, tragedy, contained emotions, overcoming anger, to name a few.
We're going to listen to one that y'all sent over. So let's take a quick listen, and then we can unpack it a little bit after we hear it.
So here you go, Fee. This is the Uncuffed Playlist, and I'm still DJ Force, with a voice that makes you want to rejoice. What you just heard was Outstanding by the Gap Band. And of course, Keith Sweat, I Wanna. But everything was not outstanding with my girl Felicia. You know, you have the highs and lows sometimes, the ups and the downs. And on Christmas Day in 1984, I went to juvenile hall. I was guilty. I went to juvenile hall for assaulting two other teenagers. My family, they were having some get together with other family members. I didn't want to attend. Felicia's family, her mother and her sister, I don't know, maybe Butch, they were having some sort of Christmas get together. I didn't want to attend that. I was going through some turmoil of my own. So I went out with a friend, and we were just walking the streets. And anybody who happened to be on the streets when we were on the streets, we did the awful thing of assaulting them just for the sake of doing it. So I ended up in juvenile hall. When I went to juvenile hall, the first thought that came to my mind was, oh my God, I'm gonna lose my girlfriend. I didn't wanna lose Felicia. I had no reason to think that I was gonna lose her, but I was afraid. I didn't feel so tough when I thought I was gonna lose my girl.
First of all, I mean, it's like his voice is made for radio. I mean, he sounds amazing and just also being so vulnerable. Mariah, when you see this, like the inception of this and then putting this together and then you actually listen to it, you really have this front row seat of this transformation. How is that for you?
The more of these pieces that I'm able to listen through to the whole thing as we finalize the editing, the more and more blown away I am by the level of authenticity and vulnerability that people are willing to bring in a space where it can be very challenging to be vulnerable for a variety of reasons. I am truly blown away again and again by the level of dedication, seriousness, and also compassion and positivity for the other students around them that I see the student DJs bringing week after week. Everyone in that class wants everyone else in that class to be able to bring their best selves to that program.
Let's listen to one more. This is DeAndre.
In this part, I want to talk about the distance that I felt, the emotion that I felt was just heartbreak. I felt angry. I was confused, and all these things led me to kind of like steer away from my family. You know, I wasn't really connected with everybody like I normally would, and I just felt like it was kind of like a why God type of thing for me. Like, why did that have to happen to my little brother? Somebody that I talked to pretty much every other day, FaceTime, you know, coming to me for advice and stuff like that, and I ain't have him no more, so. But this is why I say that music is so much more than just something you listen to. It's something that really gets you out of things and gets you through the struggle. It's a savior for a lot of people, you know, because it's like music is what got me through that time period, even though I was going through the struggle and going through the most. And then I always know how to be there for my family, my kids, missing their uncle and whatnot. It was just like, okay, I was playing music to get me up every day, playing music to be able to go to work and be able to look these people that I really don't got nothing in common with in the face and be able to still do my job and, you know, make the chicken and go home, you know. But I just feel like, yeah, everything I went through, music helped me be stronger for it, you know, and it was where I could not talk to certain people about certain stuff. Music was my communication, you know what I'm saying, to the outside world, you know. And a lot of times, like, we could use songs to kind of explain to people what we're going through. I didn't really know how to sit there and talk to my girl about what I was going through, but I knew she understood what I was going through based off of certain songs that I listened to and stuff. So,
oh, that resonates with so many people. I mean, I think music is universal in what it can do for you in terms of a support if you don't even have the emotional vocabulary to kind of understand and process what you're going through. So this weekend was really like the first playlist drop. How did it go?
It was fantastic. It broadcast both on KALW, and then we celebrated, Uncuffed had its first in-person celebration of the Uncuffed playlist and also a re-entry program that we've been doing outside of the state prisons. And the response is overwhelming and overwhelmingly positive. And these pieces will continue to air. They'll be rolling out on a weekly basis on KALW on Friday and Saturday nights at midnight. But perhaps even more exciting is we are in the process of finalizing licensing to be able to broadcast these pieces inside all of the California state prisons through the institutional television programming there. And I think the opportunity to hear incarcerated voices on the outside is priceless. And I think the opportunity for other incarcerated people to hear other incarcerated people is equally important.
Chanton, how does it feel to listen to these excerpts? I mean, you went from a co-host to now you're a listener.
I mean, it brings me back to being in the studio with the team and coming up with a subject. And then also hearing them share their story is exactly what you heard when we get together and do a story. It brings up so much emotion, so much memories, and it tells the story of a person, not of a felon.
Chanton, how did this experience really shape, you know, your life, your careers, and your passions?
Yeah.
Because I think when we chatted, when we first had our initial chat on Friday, you were mentoring youth and young adults.
Yeah, I mentor youth and young adults now. I do reentry work for folks that are getting released from the county jail or prison. I do a lot of advocating for immigrant rights. This year, we're running the Home Act to keep folks from being detained and letting them come home to their family. And the experience that I receive from everybody that podcast with me was like, this is our chance to come home and give back to the community that we took from for so many years. We all talked about it, like if we ever had a chance to come back to our community, we'll help our community, and through our stories and a narrative, hopefully help the youth not make the same mistakes that we made and spent decades incarcerated. So I'm living that as we speak, and from everything I learn, I'm using it and utilizing it every day.
Yeah, and sharing it with others, which is wonderful. Eli, when it comes to the Uncuffed program, how unique is this? Is this unique to California and the country?
Well, we are part of Prison Radio International, which is a new group of people doing prison radio projects around the world, as the name suggests. So last summer, we went to Norway for the first ever conference of people doing this work. There's not that many programs in the States. There's another program in Colorado that started recently. And actually, Uncuffed is broadcasting now on Colorado Prison Radio. There's, of course, the podcast Ear Hustle, also out of San Quentin, which some former participants in our program helped start up, and we stay close with them. But there's programs, there's prison radio in Argentina, in India, there's a jail radio program, Australia, all over the world, all over Europe. So it's been a fantastic to get connected with all these different groups who, in lots of different ways and doing lots of different kinds of programming, are connecting with this thing that the voice helps convey humanity, and especially in prison, where I think, you know, the images of people can be so dehumanizing, and the visuals can be. Dehumanizing, the voice helps connect people on the inside with folks on the outside.
I agree. Well, Eli, Mariah, and Chanton, thank you so much for the time and really the great work behind this.
Really appreciate it, Vicky. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vicky.
And that is Eli Wirtschafter, the Uncuffed Program Director, Mariah Yates, the lead teacher of the Uncuffed Broadcast DJ program in Solano State Prison, and Chanton Bunn, a graduate of the storytelling program at San Quentin State Prison and a former co-host of the Uncuffed podcast. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Helping people help themselves. That's the mission of the University of California Cooperative Extension, which applies academia and research to local issues across the state. An issue that transcends communities is wildfire risk, and landowners play a pretty crucial role in managing that risk. An upcoming workshop series is helping landowners develop plans to improve and protect their forest lands, focusing on Sacramento and Solano counties. Texas. Susie Coker is a forest advisor with the Central Sierra Cooperative Extension and joins us with more. You know, Susie, the last time, before we dive into this workshop series, I just want to check in with you because the last time we checked in with you was during these like crazy atmospheric rivers. You live up in Myers near South Lake Tahoe. How is everything faring in your community and your home?
Well, most of the snow is melted, at least at lake level. We are still getting a lot of snow melt coming down from higher elevation. So there's still snow on the mountains, but everything is lush and green and beautiful. We did have about 40 structures collapse in South Lake Tahoe due to snow load. And so there's one down the street from me where there was damage, not collapse, but my neighbors are getting their houses fixed and trying to move back in after that big heavy snow.
And I think that just really illustrates that, you know, I mean, you go from one threat and hazard, you know, potentially to another, especially living up in forested communities. And you don't have to only be in the Sierra for that, right? So can you tell us a little bit about the issues that private forest land owners in California, what they're facing?
Sure. And first, I'd just like to describe who these folks are. Mm-hmm. California has 100 million acres. So an acre is a football field without the end zones. So that's the size of California. And about a third of that, 32 million acres, is forested, which means it has conifers or at least 10% tree cover by oak woodlands. And of that 32 million, 12 million acres are owned privately. 5 million are industrial timber companies growing fiber. But even more, 7 million acres are owned by regular people, just like you and I. 75,000 of them own more than 10 acres of forest in California. So unlike public or private industrial lands, these folks do not generally have a lot of cash sitting around, a lot of experts. Some may have generations of experience, but others are brand new at owning forest land or brand new newly realizing that they need to manage their forests because of wildfires. So there's a huge need to get a lot of forest fuels reduction and thinning done on those types of properties. And not a lot of funding, knowledge, contractors to get it done. So people face a big challenge in trying to get moving on reducing the risk of wildfire on their private property.
Mm. And that's why this workshop series is here to help some of those private landowners. It's been around since 2019. How does it work?
We have funding from CAL FIRE. We have hosted 24 cohorts across the state. Right now, we're at a 9-week online Zoom sessions with one in-person field day focused in a particular area. And the workshop we have coming up in July 18th, it starts, is in Solano. And so people can attend from that region or they can attend from any region because it is primarily online. Mm-hmm. And once what we go through there is things like understanding permitting, regulation, all sorts of forest ecology, vegetation management, and the financials. We help people understand potential for cost share programs and hook them up with professionals that could actually help them get the work done. And the best part is we have funding once they've completed the workshop series to get a registered professional forester to visit their property and give them site-specific advice on how to move forward with their goals.
Yeah, that's incredibly valuable. Given that you've had, I believe, 24 cohorts so far, have you seen a change in public reception to forest management, you know, in the 4 years or so that you've been doing this?
I mostly get the people who are pretty enthusiastic to start with because they're willing to sit through a 9-week workshop. But I would say the summers of 2020 and 2021 were pretty extreme with wildfire. And so people who were maybe on the fence about what they needed to do seem to no longer be. I just really meet motivated landowners who want to work hard to get their properties safer. Some of the people we meet actually have already been through a wildfire. Maybe they've already had all their trees burn or lost their house. And as a result, we started another workshop series on post-fire management that we're doing around the state as well. That talks all about fuels, dead tree removal, soil erosion, salvage logging, replanting, and controlling vegetation around those new trees so that they can survive into the future. So We've been able to expand due to funding from the U.S. Forest Service based on those needs that we've met.
If you're a landowner who's kind of just a beginner, a novice when it comes to forest management and the importance and the awareness for it, how does this workshop series in forest stewardship kind of make it accessible, you know, to people who are really just at the inception of this?
Yeah, I mean, I hope people aren't intimidated that they're taking a university level class, because it is a workshop. We know we have adult learners. We have a lot of online materials. People work at their own pace. And then with our Zoom sessions, we have very short presentations from experts. And then they individuals taking the workshop series can ask their own personalized questions and learn about how to do things on their own property. There's so much in forestry that depends on the type of forest you have and that sort of thing. So really getting individualized advice, I think, is one way we do that. And then people connect with each other, too. So we have these cohorts of learners who are actually learning from each other. They may meet their neighbors who have already done a project, and they can continue to go and see how other people around them are doing it. And I think that is the best kind of education for adults.
When we think about forest management, our eyes may go up in elevation to the foothills and the Sierra, but this workshop series is heading down in elevation towards Solano and Sacramento counties. Why focus? And I understand it's on Zoom, so you can pretty much join anywhere. But why kind of highlight and conduct outreach and reach out to people in Solano and Sacramento counties?
A lot of land owned in the foothills or forested land is owned by remote landowners. They own property that they may not live on. About half of the people that we actually work with live on their property, and the other half live elsewhere and actually visit their property or may not even have any kind of dwelling on it. And so we have found a lot of interest in our bigger urban areas for these workshops, so that people can think about how to go out to their property and what they need to do once they get there, because their time is usually pretty limited there.
What feedback have you received over the years from people who took part in this workshop?
Oh, a lot of really great feedback. Very high marks for learning and getting started. A lot of people tell us they just don't even know where to start, you know, with huge wildfire seasons, especially if, potentially if you inherited a property and you never even knew much about it. How do you get started? So we have those types of great interactions for those new folks learning from people who've owned property for a while and that sort of thing. I think the other ways that things are accessible is having that registered professional forester come and visit you on your property once you can complete the workshop. So you can have personalized advice from an expert. So that's a really great way to get started.
Yeah, it's kind of like replacing or breaking down that barrier of feeling intimidated and overwhelmed, and then replacing it with being empowered and feeling like, hey, I can do this and take the right step forward. Finally, Susie, just some like housekeeping bullet points. How much does it cost and how long of a commitment is it?
It's $60 for 9 weeks. We pay for your lunch for our in-person field day and give you a cool tree measuring stick to take home with you. It's in evenings, an hour and a half from 6 to 7:30. I think this one's on Wednesdays. We have two websites where you can go and sign up. It's UCANR, ANR is Ag and Natural Resources, University of California, .edu/forestry workshops. And if you want to find out more about the post-fire workshops, all about what to do after your forest burns, you can go to UCANR.edu/post-fire workshops, post-fire workshops.
Susie, thank you so much. And we have a link for more information on our Insight page, too.
Thank you.
And that is Susie Coker, Forest Advisor with the Central Sierra Cooperative Extension, discussing an upcoming Forest Stewardship Workshop Series for Solano and Sacramento counties, which starts next month, and that helps landowners reduce wildfire risk and develop plans to improve and protect their forest lands. And with that, that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.